Rasmussen. The city of Portland declared an impasse this afternoon in negotiations with a coalition of seven unions representing 1,600 city workers. Negotiators for the city decided to step away from plans that have been ongoing since February over its insistence on stripping language from a contract that would provide cost savings analysis when the city outsources jobs, according to representatives for the District Council of Trade Unions, or DCTU. KBOO's Mike Clever spoke to Rob Whedon, a representative for the American Federations of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Local 189, and chief negotiator for DCTU.
What city workers does the DCTU represent?
We represent all of the, basically, the largest union within the city of Portland. We represent the Maintenance Bureau, or the Bureau of Transportation, any people that are paving your streets, the Water Bureau, people that are providing all the clean water to the city, people that maintain our parks. Those are the frontline workers that you see every day. We also represent the inspectors, the parking enforcement, you name it. I mean, the office support employees, pretty much everybody but firefighters and police, and some of the professional staff. So,
can you talk about labor negotiations thus far with the city?
Yeah, we've been bargaining since February 19th. Early on, the city had notified us that contracting out was an issue that they'd like to address. We've been working with them trying to find a solution that they can live with. This was an issue during our last negotiations, and it resulted in a pretty substantial rewrite of the clause then. Now they're proposing to delete all of the language that we agreed to just 3 years ago, and they're looking to delete the provision that requires that the city actually save money before they contract out our work.
The contentious language is about outsourcing. What is your opposition to outsourcing?
Well, typically, we don't necessarily have a problem with outsourcing when it comes to capital improvement projects or areas where the city's going to save some money and still provide decent jobs. Our problem comes in when we have situations like the parking meter scandal that occurred back in 2007. In this instance, our members are able to go through and upgrade the parking meters on the spot versus the contractor who had jackhammered them all up, put them in a truck, and take them to a warehouse and do the same repair there, bring them back, and reinstall them. It's just not a good use of taxpayer dollars, and, it's work that my people would rather do.
The city has officially declared an impasse in negotiations. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so where do negotiations go from here?
Well, hopefully we'll, with the help of the mediator, we'll get them back to the bargaining table. But at this point, they're saying, by declaring impasse, they're saying that they don't think that talks would be beneficial. So at some point, the city is moving closer towards, after a 30-day waiting period, they can go ahead and implement their last, best, and final offer. Likewise, we have the option of striking, which is something that we've been really trying hard to avoid.
So, is the rank and file of the DCTU opposed to a strike?
We have not had. I guess it depends on who you ask. I mean, we a lot of our members, we've heard from a lot of vocal members that are clamoring to fight this at all costs. And there's a lot of people that really just have not been engaged in the process thus so far. So we're going to be talking to those members and seeing what they want to do.
So potentially, though, in the case of a strike, this could have a wide-ranging effect on services that are necessary services and provided throughout the city.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, at this time of year, we're talking, you need the DCTU employees to plow the streets if there happens to be a weather event, to fix the main breaks that are occurring on a regular basis right now. For that matter, the people that are working at the headworks, making sure we have clean water. These are vital, vital services for this community, absolutely.
And no further meetings have been scheduled with the city thus far to negotiate from here?
Nope.
Okay.
No further meetings, so we're hoping to meet soon.
All right. Well, Mr. Whedon, I thank you for your time.
No, thank you.
That was KBOO's Mike Klepfer.
9 months and over 100 hours have been spent in negotiation between Portland Public Schools and the Portland Teachers Association on new teacher contracts. Despite that investment of time, there has been no settlement, and now both sides are preparing for the possibility of a teacher walkout. If the teachers, who have been working without a contract since June, do go on strike, the district will be forced to call on up to 900 substitutes who have a no-strike clause written into their contracts. Since there are close to 3,000 teachers employed by the Portland Public Schools, the substitutes will not be able to fulfill the amount of coverage needed by the district. District spokesman Rob Cowie says they're working toward a settlement and attempting to avoid a strike. A state mediator has made herself available to the negotiating parties, and recently both sides have stated that they see an encouraging outcome emerging. After a holiday cooling-off period, the two sides began a new bargaining session last Thursday, which continued today, in an attempt to reach an agreement between the parties on health care and salary benefits. Both sides hope to reach an agreement soon.
Two Portland police officers got themselves in trouble over the holidays, one for violating his parole by vandalizing a neighbor's vehicle, and the other for posting a YouTube video shooting guns and shoving suspects. The officers on the video call themselves a tough son of a SOB, excuse me, then shoots off his gun multiple times at a firing range. The video was posted on December 31st by Ghetto Productions, but was removed on January 3rd, but not before the officer on the tape was identified as Alfonso Valadez, who's been a Portland police officer for just over 2 years. Valadez is being investigated for posting the video online. As for the other Portland officer who found himself on the wrong side of the law over the holidays, he's been identified as Homero Renaga, who was arrested on New Year's Eve after an altercation with a neighbor. He's already serving probation for driving under the influence in 2012. In addition to a criminal mischief charge, Renaga is facing jail time for violating the terms of his parole.
A federal judge in Washington has decided to allow a legal challenge to coal transport across the state by the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad to continue. The lawsuit argues that the coal trains violate the state's Clean Water Act because of the amount of coal dust that ends up in lakes and rivers. A coalition of environmental groups came together to file the lawsuit against the railroad BNSF, owned by multi-billionaire Warren Buffett. Krista Collard with the Sierra Club spoke with KBOO about the lawsuit today.
The district court in Eastern Washington is going to allow our case to go forward because BNSF has been moving about 4 trains of coal through Washington State every day and polluting Washington waterways with coal dust and the surfactants that go along with those. So the court has decided to let this case move forward, and we're very excited about that. It's a big step towards cleaning up our waterways and our communities from polluters. BNSF is the target of the lawsuit. They are the shippers of coal through Washington. They're the second largest coal shipper in the United States, so they ship coal through 28 states across countless bodies of water. They do travel through the state of Washington, and the impact is that they ultimately end up losing a lot of coal dust. We've seen the vice president of BNSF, they've testified in front of the Surface Transportation Board that their trains actually lose between 500 and 3,000 pounds of coal dust per trip. And that's actually just the coal cars themselves. There's about 120 coal cars per train. So we're talking about a lot of coal dust that's going into our precious waterways, and that's just unacceptable. It's unacceptable. So they certainly need to find a way to mitigate that problem. The coal exports debate has been very big in Washington and Oregon, and that's because, you know, Washington right now only sees 4 trains, and that's already having a devastating effect on the waterways. But if the coal export proposal is hoping for, and the coal companies, we're talking about, you know, increasing the number of trains by tenfold or over tenfold. We're talking about cities like Spokane, Washington, seeing 42, you know, mile-long coal trains coming through their city every single day. Those coal trains will be about a mile to a mile and a half long, so they will likely be on average around 120 cars per train. And so the impacts are could be very, very devastating, and we certainly want them to, you know, mitigate the problem now with the four coal trains that are having an impact, and before, you know, if 40 trains would be coming through.
That's four a day?
That was Krista Collard with the Sierra Club talking about the lawsuit against a railway company owned by Warren Buffett challenging the transport of coal through Washington State.
A train that exploded last week in Castleton, North Dakota, was carrying oil mixed with chemicals deemed to be highly volatile, according to government documents. In an exclusive first reported by Peter Horn of dsmogblog.com on January 2nd, the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration issued a major safety alert regarding the dangers of transporting oil from the Bakken shale formation, which lies partially under North Dakota. BNSF Railroad was the operator of the train full of Bakken oil, which was extracted by fracking. The explosion on which December 30th sent a 100-foot-tall fireball into the air and forced authorities to recommend evacuation for areas 5 miles away from the site of the blast. The alert states that fracked oil contains volatile organic compounds which oil companies are expected to flare off before transportation. These include benzene, xylene, and hexane. Another revelation in the story is that the company set to receive the 100-plus cars of oil, Marquis Missouri Terminal, acknowledged the heightened danger of fracked oil cargo in its permit application to the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. No one was injured in the North Dakota blast, but a train carrying crude oil through La Majantique, Quebec, on July 2013, derailed and exploded, vaporizing and killing 47 people. The Port of Vancouver approved a lease this summer with Tesoro Savage to transport Bakken oil through the Columbia River Gorge. The agreement needs approval by Washington Governor Jay Inslee in order to proceed and is opposed by a coalition of environmental groups.
Another megaload shipment of heavy tar sands oil extracting equipment to Canada is awaiting a special permit to be shipped from the Port of Umatilla. Two other shipments of the equipment, carried by Oregon-based shipper Omega Morgan, are already en route and currently in Idaho. The megaloads are carrying machinery used in the process known as steam-assisted gravity drainage, which is similar to fracking. Opponents of the tar sands oil, who have previously delayed the shipment of the megaloads, believe the shipment may start moving as early as this week. Currently, the first megaload is in Gibbonsville, Idaho, 10 miles from the Montana border, and is still awaiting a permit from the Montana Department of Transportation. KBOO will feature a special program on the megaloads hosted by Paul Rowland with several Umatilla tribe members this Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. in place of the normal Wisdom of the Elders programming.
Much of the U.S. is currently being hit with extremely cold weather in what's being termed a polar inversion. While meteorologists are careful to point out that no single weather event can be linked to climate change, multiple studies have shown a possible link between the melting of Arctic ice and the cold weather events along the jet stream. Professor Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University is the co-author of one of these studies. She spoke with KBOO's Janka Soderberg about her study of the impact of Arctic ice melt on the jet stream.
Do you think, through your studies, that there may be a link to the Arctic ice melt and the jet stream?
The jet stream controls all of our weather. And right now, the jet stream, as we look at it in sort of the whole northern hemisphere, is in what we call a very amplified configuration. That means that there are huge swings northward and southward all around the northern hemisphere. And it just so happens that here on the East Coast, we happen to be under one of these big southward dips that allows the very cold air from the Arctic to plunge southward. I mean, this happens naturally. The New England and the Northeast experiences cold events like this regularly in the wintertime. But the pattern that is around the northern hemisphere right now, while it's very cold here in the east, it's been extremely warm up in Alaska and up in the Arctic. And this is because the jet stream is surging way south in those areas. And so what our research has shown is that as the Arctic has continued to warm 2 to 3 times faster than areas farther south, these very amplified patterns in the jet stream are becoming more frequent. And this, we believe, will lead to more of these sort of bizarre weather events where we saw rain falling in northern Alaska in December for the first time ever, while we had very, very cold conditions throughout the center of the United States. And this is all related to the jet stream taking this very wavy, trajectory as it travels around the northern hemisphere.
I understand that these changes in the jet stream are also impacting transatlantic flights.
Yes, there was a study recently that talked about the turbulence increasing in the upper levels of the atmosphere where jets fly. And I don't know too much more about that exactly, because the turbulence is really a complicated creature in the atmosphere, and there are a lot of things that cause it. But one thing we can say, that if the jet stream continues to weaken in its west to east winds, then we would expect transatlantic flights to be a little slower going from west to east, and then a little faster going from east to west.
Well, I know one thing our listeners would be especially concerned about is whether this polar ice melt is something that is reversible. Is it something that people can actually do something about, or is it too late?
Well, we've gone very far down this road of putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The concentrations now are higher than they've been in at least 800,000 years. It's happened very rapidly because we've started burning so many fossil fuels just since, say, the 1950s or so. And to turn this around is going to be very difficult. You know, we've increased the greenhouse gas concentration by 40% already, and every year we've increased the emissions. And so not only are we not slowing down what we've been doing, it's actually been accelerating. But that's not to say that people shouldn't do everything they can do to try, because everything we can do to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere will help slow this process down.
Again, I've been speaking with Professor Jennifer Francis of Rutgers University about the impact of Arctic ice melt on the jet stream and extreme weather, particularly in the northeast of the United States. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the news broadcast for an interview between KBOO's Jimmy Tardy, who speaks with Liz Ford, professor of labor law at Seattle University, about the recent Boeing machinist contract vote. That will be followed by Labor Radio at 6 o'clock and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is forecast to have a high temperature of 43 degrees with a 70% chance of rain. Tonight, there's a 20% chance of rain with an expected low temperature of 40 degrees. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 31 counts per minute in Damascus, Oregon, with a high of 42. Powell Butte in southeast Portland measures 26 CPM. In Raleigh Hills, the radiation count is 30 CPM, with a high of 42. Medford, Oregon has 36 CPM, high of 51. Vancouver, British Columbia has 38 CPM, high of 48. And Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 33 CPM with spikes up to 55. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
The time is 5:21, and we go now to Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
What a Christmas little Bastrop had. It's still a mystery how Santa Claus got it down the chimney, but Bastrop got a present boys dream about, a big honking steel-clad war toy called MRAP. But Bastrop is not a six-year-old boy, and an MRAP is not a toy. Bastrop is a Texas county of some 75,000 people, and MRAP stands for Mine-Resistant Ambush Protected. It's a heavily armored military vehicle, one of several versions of war tanks that have become the hot must-have playthings of police departments all across the country. Are the good people of Bastrop facing some imminent terrorist threat that warrants military? It's a very pleasant, laid-back place. And while the county is named for a 19th-century land developer from the Netherlands who was wanted for embezzlement in his home country, The relatively few crimes in Bastrop today don't rise above the level of routine police work. Even the Sheriff's Department, which is the proud owner of the MRAP, says it doesn't have a particular use for the war machine, but, quote, it's here if we need it. Well, yeah, but that same feeble rationale would apply if the county decided to get an atom bomb. You just never know when a big mushroom cloud might come in handy. The Pentagon, which gave the MRAP to Bastrop and our sprawling Department of Homeland Security, are haphazardly spreading war equipment, war techniques, and a war mentality to what are supposed to be our community's peacekeepers and crime solvers. This is Jim Hightower saying, having the technology and the mindset for military actions, local authorities will find excuses to substitute them for honest police work, turning common citizens into suspects and enemies. As a spokesman for the Bastrop Sheriff's Department said of the MRAP, with today's society, there's no way the thing won't be used. How comforting is that?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The Portland nonprofit group Elders in Action is reporting an increase of con artists plotting scams against the elderly. The amount of phone calls, stolen utilities, and false claims of grandchildren in distress has risen to an all-time high, according to the agency. Executive Director Leslie Foran from Elders in Action says the group has been meeting regularly with Department of Justice investigators and law enforcement in attempts to catch the latest scams and bring awareness to the growing community of elders being targeted. Since older adults are usually home during the day, and cons assist to work towards bringing attention to the subject in the hopes of helping elderly adults and their children and prevent them from suffering the impact of being targeted. More information can be found at www.eldersinaction.org.
The War on Poverty was launched 50 years ago this week by Lyndon Johnson in his 1964 State of the Union Address. For an update on the effort, KBOOF's Joe Meyer spoke with Jill Quidongo on the Institute for Public Accuracy.
In the 1960s, Presidents Johnson and Nixon spoke of ending poverty in America and launched ambitious federal programs to achieve their ambition. Here's author and activist Jill Quidongo.
You really don't hear very much about the programs of the War on Poverty or about the goal of abolishing poverty, which was at the center of Lyndon Johnson's vision. The central program, the community action programs, and these programs were designed or intended to maximize the participation of the poor, so they weren't going to be controlled by any existing power structure, but the poor people themselves would be involved in the administration of these programs. And so they were a very powerful source of social change in places like Mississippi, for example. Action programs were created, and local politicians would apply to the Office of Economic Opportunity for funds to run the program if the poor are included, and for the most part in Mississippi, that meant African Americans. And so the power of the federal government to deny funds to local whites and instead put African Americans in charge was a tremendous source of empowerment. Ultimately, in many places, led to a backlash against the program. So they became very unpopular in many, many states, and ultimately were pretty much defunded entirely.
So you would say that public sentiment was out in front of that federal change?
I'd say there was a lot of white backlash against what started out as a program for all the poor. I think the initial vision was not that it would be a program that would be tied into the goal of racial integration or black empowerment, but when it became that and made a white backlash that ended up destroying any kind of political support for community action programs.
How is this different from the Irish poor or the Italian poor?
I think those easier to to move up in the social hierarchy. They started out with many of the same kinds of problems of discrimination and poverty, but they didn't start out with the history of slavery, and they didn't start out with a total lack of opportunity for education.
What do you see as the rightful role of the federal government? If they're just going to give block grants, why do we want to send our money to the federal level?
I think one of the most successful federal programs is the Earned Income Tax Credit. This was an idea that was actually first considered by the Nixon administration, and he supported the idea of a negative income tax where it would include everybody. There would be a basic minimum income.
Wow, so Nixon is way left of Obama.
Way left. I mean, many of Nixon's ideas would now be considered very radical. He believed, for instance, in subsidized housing, and he had an ambitious program to provide housing for the poor and housing subsidies for low-income families. But his program ran into civil rights issues as well, because if you would help people, it might be in a white neighborhood, and people in the suburbs didn't want poor inner city minorities moving into their neighborhoods in subsidized housing.
Anything else for our KBOO listeners?
I would just like to add that I think we sometimes, when we're talking about the war on poverty, we forget that the really big success story of the Johnson administration was Medicare. It's been almost 50 years now since Medicare was enacted, and that's brought me and given them a guarantee of health insurance.
That was Jill Quandango, author of The Color of Welfare and Other. And I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
An obscure branch of the U.S. Department of Agriculture may soon face inquiry. General announced recently that an investigation into allegations of animal cruelty by U.S. Wildlife Services is being launched. Calls for a review began coming from animal rights groups over a year ago, and politicians like Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio have stepped in and described the office of as the least accountable federal agency he's ever seen. An agency trapper from Wyoming posted a video last October of a trapped coyote, later went viral and prompted more signatures calling for the agent's dismissal. DeFazio's office contends that the agency acts as an extermination service for golf clubs and resorts, as well as corporate entities like Weyerhaeuser and International Paper on public land.
A new environmental impact statement dismisses concerns of a class of genetically engineered crops and the toxic herbicide they were manufactured to resist. The document, published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Inspection Service, begins the process for potential deregulation of the genetically modified seeds. The draft environmental impact statement will be available online for public review on January 10th. Once published, citizens have 45 days to voice comment on the draft statement. The USDA has considered Dow AgroSciences' Weed Killer 2,4-D to be safe. Dow AgroSciences has asked the USDC to deregulate one variety of corn and two varieties of soybean seeds genetically engineered to resist the weed killer. The selling of corn and soybean seeds genetically engineered to resist 2,4-D, ingredient also used in Agent Orange, could be possible in the future. Some farmers have been eager for a new generation of herbicide-resistant seeds because of the prevalence of weeds that have become immune to Monsanto's Roundup. But skeptics are concerned that the use of the new seeds and 2,4-D will only lead to exponentially rising problems of the weeds resistant to that chemical.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a halt to Utah's legalization of same-sex marriages. In a two-sentence order issued without comment or dissent, the nation's highest court put on hold a federal appeal judge's December 20th ruling that same-sex marriage is constitutional. That ruling struck down the state's constitutional ban on gay marriage, which came in a lawsuit brought by pro-gay marriage groups. The state of Utah has been appealing a lower court ruling, which would let the marriages stand while the state's appeal is under review. Hundreds of gay couples have been married in Utah since the ruling and are now in legal limbo. Utah expressed a desire to the Supreme Court to invalidate the marriages should the state emerge victorious in the case. The matter thrusts the issue of constitutionality of gay marriage back into the national spotlight. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which denied gay couples benefits. And a separate ruling paved the way for the repeal of California's gay marriage ban. In both cases, the court made efforts to avoid sweeping judgments about the constitutionality of same-sex marriage. The appeals court handling the Utah case has agreed on an expedited schedule to settle the matter.
Senator Bernie Sanders has received an answer to a letter he sent to National Security Agency chief asking if the NSA has been spying on members of Congress. Rather than draft a direct response to Sanders, the NSA issued a public statement. The agency said in its statement that politicians are entitled to as much privacy protection as the rest of the population. Two federal judges issued contradictory verdicts on whether the widespread NSA surveillance was constitutional last month. Appeals have been filed in both cases, and they're currently working their way through the courts.
Late last week, in a close vote by Boeing machinists, the deal secures a major era in exchange for workers' pensions and other labor concessions. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Boeing union machinist Jim Levitt.
Boeing came in and said, we are going to freeze that pension plan in September of 2016. You will get what's in the pension for you up until then, but any years beyond 2016 will not be credited as service time. Instead, we're going to put in a 401k plan. It's an enormous cut in our overall compensation.
Point in labor movement at Boeing, 35 years.
We've essentially lost not only the pension here, we have lost collective bargaining, because Boeing will never again wait until the end of a contract to negotiate with us. There are at least two more airplane programs that will need to be renewed before this contract is over in 2024. So Boeing is going to come back and say, give us back some more, take less, and we will be bound by the terms of the contract. We will not be able to strike. It will be another take it or we leave situation. And just to see how in your face this whole thing was, when negotiations started up, the union told Boeing that the pension was non-negotiable. Boeing came back insisting on ending the defined benefit pension. 3 days later, after our local leadership had told Boeing this was not acceptable, Boeing's board held a meeting where they announced a $10 billion stock buyback and a 50% increase in the dividend, which is worth another $2 billion, in a year when the stock had already gone up 80%. This was as direct a transfer of wealth from the workers to the stockholders as you could imagine. They told us on Thursday, we're taking your pension, and on Sunday, they hand holders.
How did you go in November, rejecting at 67% to passing at 51%?
We had 6 weeks of a tremendous political pressure campaign put on us. The governor, mayors, many of them endorsed and supported by our union, incidentally. There were ads telling us that we needed to vote yes on this contract for the children. We had to save the aerospace industry in the region. It was all on us. Somehow the idea that Boeing is the one threatening to leave never seemed to enter the equation. We also faced another major problem. The Machinist Union International leadership was in bed with the company on this. The spokespeople for the International said the same things that the corporate spokespeople did. They sent out very misleading literature about how wonderful the contract was, not mentioning the huge loss that was going to be entailed with the end of the defined benefit pension. And they forced our local leadership in November to not take a position recommending yes or no to the membership, which created, the union been clearly calling for a rejection in November, I think that first contract would have been rejected by an 85 or 90%. And for the second contract vote, our local leadership unanimously recommended rejection, while the international was sending out communications to us. They never came out forthrightly and said vote yes, but everything in there was this is wonderful, you need to save your jobs, blah, blah, blah. So it was clear to anybody who could read and hear that the International wanted us to vote yes on this. So you had clear division between the local leadership elected by the membership here and the International in Washington, D.C.
That was union machinist Jim Levitt. He told us workers not only lost their pension, but their very right to collective bargaining. What's it worth? $12 billion windfall profit for stockholders. With KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Abeni Ibotson, Ginny Conges, Mike Kleffer, Joe Meyer, and Robin Ryan. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin, with special thanks to Paul Rowland. Our engineer is Danielle Parks, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Ross Freeman-Levin. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gunz. The Abe and Joe talk radio show. Abe Proctor and Joe Uris tackle legalized marijuana and the increasingly silly war on drugs. At 9 on Alternative Radio, the Institute for Public Policy's Drug Policy Project speaks on End the Drug War. And at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Her guest is former civil rights attorney Lynn Stewart, who was just released from prison.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D-May Roberts features playwright David Henry Hwang, Tony Award-winning author of M. Butterfly, Dance on the Railroad, and Chinglish, which opens on January 11th at Portland Center Stage. And at 11:30, D-May hosts a special Stage and Studio Extra with POV Dance about an unusual dance and multimedia installation performance in the historic landmark building, Left Bank.
Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. And stay tuned now. For a pre-recorded interview conducted by KBOO's Jimmy Tardy with Liz Ford, professor of labor law at Seattle University, about the recent Boeing machinist contract vote. Good night, John.
Good night, Ross.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm speaking with Liz Ford, who is the Visiting Assistant Professor and Associate Director of the Externship Program at Seattle University School of Law. Ms. Ford has a long history in labor law, including establishing the Seattle University Law School's first mediation clinic, labor law, legal writing, collective bargaining, and negotiation.
Right. I practiced for many years as a labor lawyer. So I represented unions, and then I've sat on the other side of the table a bit as well.
Okay, so you have an insight into what's going on as far as with the Boeing machinists, which saw a vote Friday to accept the contract that was offered by Boeing, specifically relating to the production of their 777X, which is a next-generation plane, which is a fuel-efficient 400-passenger jet airliner. The issue has been whether the 777 would continue to be built in the Puget Sound area, at least for the most part built in the Puget Sound area, or whether the contract would be rejected by the machinists and that work would move elsewhere in the country. So Liz, of course, this issue, I guess based on its size, has gotten a lot of attention, and also based on the size of the local machinist union in Seattle there, a lot of people have looked at this in, I guess you would say, unflattering terms as far as what it means to the union, with some people saying that this is a turning point in union relations overall. And when they say a turning point, they're saying that any initial comments on the overall situation?
Oh, I wish I had more insight into it, but I certainly have been thinking about it a lot, as we all have. And I think that it certainly is incredibly visible and in that way historic. I think that there is a way in which this kind of sort of demonstrates a problem that's not new, and that has to do with, I think, two things. One is the very tangible question of whether or not pensions, as they've historically been known, are really a creature of the past. And what I mean by pension is a defined benefit pension. That is, when you retire, you know what you're going to be receiving month by month based on a formula that's been set in advance, rather than having your, what some now think of as a pension, which is really investment account.
The 401ks.
The 401ks, exactly. And the risk onto the individual, as opposed to being that risk being borne by a larger institution, say an employer, or in the case of Social Security, the government. What we're doing, I think, as a society, or as a country at least, is switching that and placing that risk on the individual. So I think the Boeing agreement is not dissimilar from what's happening on many, many other bargaining tables, and that is that the union is being in some ways forced to give up that defined benefit pension in favor of a defined contribution pension, a 401k. The single issue that was at play, and I think there are bigger questions here about the future of the labor movement, mm-hmm. and where we have those conversations between large companies and individual communities.
So let's talk just real quick, a couple of points here.
Yeah.
One, let's just, do you have any insight as to how, say, for instance, 401k plans, which I'm assuming are tagged to the overall stock market performance, and how those compare as defined benefit plans? Is a 401k historically a better deal for somebody who's participating in the system that way?
Right. What a great question. And the 401ks really became very prevalent when the market was just soaring in the 2000s, right? And so it looked as though those two methods of preparing for retirement were equally promising. And in fact, it looked maybe as though you could do better in the market. What we all saw in 2008 was that the risk that the market will tank. And the consequence of that isn't just that folks lose disposable, money that they weren't counting on, but they lost their ability to retire. And so the question you pose is an empirical one, and I don't have the answer to it, but I can tell you the answer will depend on the particular moment in history, how the market's doing. And so really it is less a question about which is more valuable and more a question of where do we think it's appropriate and fair to place the risk of market failure.
So this is just as opposed to a question of value, it's a question of long-term risk, especially in Boeing. Reading about this issue, I've seen people commenting that there was a lot of people getting involved in the conversation, including the media, that didn't necessarily have any reason to be commenting as they were. And this is, driven in large part by Boeing's threats to take the work elsewhere. They were submitting requests for proposals to states and basically saying, we were interested in coming to your state, but here's the terms that we're seeking. And those terms were very much in Boeing's favor, along the lines of free land to build these facilities, infrastructure development, this type of thing. Is this a situation where Boeing has sort of outplayed the unions as far as just the larger context of understanding this issue?
Yes, it's hard to know without being in the negotiation room, but I can say that there are ways in which this negotiation was very unusual. So you had the initial offer that was voted down by the membership by an enormous percentage, I can't remember the exact percentage.
I think it was 67% rejected it, and that was in November.
Okay, so we had a very strong majority rejecting the contract based primarily on the pension of the traditional pension with a 401k. And preceding that vote, the Washington State Legislature had provided Boeing with a historically large amount.
$8.7 billion tax break that was to take place over 26 years?
Right. So any standard set of incentives. But the Boeing membership, when they evaluated the question of the pension, at that point voted no, or the machinist membership, I should say. In between, then, there are a few things that happened that I think contributed to the reversal. And it's impossible to know exactly, but we do know a few things happened. One was there was a break between the local leadership of the union and the national leadership of the union, with the national advocating or recommending to the membership that they revote the proposal that had been amended by Boeing, but the pension piece had not changed.
And the national set the vote.
They did indeed.
They forced the issue.
The vote was the dynamics internally, but we do know that the vote was set for January 3rd, and that there was some worry that because there would be some members on their holiday break, that there may not be as large a turnout as there would be if the date had been set differently. So we know, number one, that something you almost never see is a public disagreement between a national and a local. And that does affect the bargaining position, perhaps feeling of, but also the membership's feeling of security, right? Their feeling. There was that. There was political pressure, the likes of which you almost never see in negotiation. And you frequently see elect an opinion one way or another, even urging one vote one another, even urging a vote one level of dialogue at the state and federal levels, urging the membership to vote yes. And I think the third thing is a little harder to actually get your arms around. But the question was, what was the we don't accept this, and the alternatives looked fairly bleak and increasingly bleak as the bids from others.
Those bids that you mentioned were definitely in Boeing's favor. There were a lot of bids from states that have a right to work, that don't have union. You mentioned earlier the concessions regarding infrastructure and the land that this facility would be built on is working. So a lot of them.
I suppose if there is a silver lining, it could be the recognition that the experienced workforce makes a difference, and the bids that came in from states that were whose workforce in aerospace had been historically there, and generally that lined up with the workforces that were not represented by them, those looked less attractive, and particularly because of the previous experience with them. So I suppose if there was a real demonstration that workforces matter.
And the Dreamliner, the 7, which was a heavily outsourced product by Boeing, which was unusual for them. And the 787 got a lot of headlines for things like smoking batteries during in-flight operations of the planes and this type of thing.
Right, and what I was that for sure, and the delays, the FAR behind schedule, was really quite a significant problem.
All of this is taking place in the context of Boeing reaping record profits. They're racking up record numbers of planes ordered. They're racking up record numbers of planes delivered. They've just upped their dividends, their stock dividends, and recording huge profits.
Right. What's so unusual about this, I mean, there are any number of things that are unusual, but what's so sort of pointedly unusual is that usually you generally see this kind of request for concessions in the context of a company that's not doing well. Boeing is doing incredibly well, and yet it put these concessions on the table, and it achieved them. So that is a shift in collective bargaining. And I would be very surprised if we didn't start seeing this in other companies. And I think it has to do with the in part at least, with the ability of states to bid against each other and to bid toward the bottom. And so it puts the union that has historically been in the position of kind of, you know, enforcing that deal. When a big company comes into a community, it comes in by agreement, and that the union historically has been the other party to that agreement. And if we don't have that, if the company can simply say, well, we don't like your deal, we're going to leave and go somewhere else where they're making us a better offer, then it makes it much more difficult to sort of have those constructive conversations about what the community's standards should be.
So we've got a number of different factors at play here, including Boeing's competitiveness with European airline manufacturer Airbus. Mm-hmm. We have Boeing sitting in a very good position economically, mm-hmm. and we have what seems to be competitive markets that are working to Boeing's advantage. Any comment you want to make about the role of perceived risk in all of that and how that is playing? Because it seems to me that this seems to be the linchpin of all of this. When you remove the guaranteed retirement income and now it's going to be a riskier 401k, mm-hmm. et cetera,
mm-hmm.
what's your comments on how risk is playing into union negotiations and maybe how that compares historically?
Yeah. So the very idea of a union was to be able to negotiate on a more level playing field with sort of big companies or companies that had joined together to increase their own leverage. And the idea was if you can increase bring a group together that whose job is to advocate for the individual workers, then that should make these negotiations more fair. What this demonstrates, at least bit by bit, is that risk, as you say, is being shifted back to those individual workers rather than the union standing as kind of a bulwark against the power of the kind of larger corporations. And so I spend some time looking at the legislative history of the National Labor Relations Act. That's the law that governs collective bargaining. And it was passed in 1935. And if you go back and read that, it's like this wonderful play, you know, many of the dynamics, I won't say all of them, but many of the dynamics that we're talking about today are exactly replicated there. We had dramatic income inequality then. We have dramatic income inequality now. We have a question of who should bear the risk of the cost of things like retirement then. We have that question now. So sort of everything old is new again.
Very interesting. I wish we had more time to talk about this subject, but unfortunately we need to wrap it up. I've been speaking with Liz Ford. She's a visiting assistant professor and associate director of the externship program, and she teaches courses in labor law, legal writing, collective bargaining, and negotiation. Thank you for your time, Liz, and for giving us a little more insight into this issue. This is a much larger issue. I want to urge people to pay attention to it.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Oregon Council 75, representing over 25,000 Oregon public and private sector employees, families, and communities. Protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members since 1942. More information at www.OregonAFSCME.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Did it work?
Good morning, or good afternoon. My name is Tina Turner-Morf, and I'd like to welcome you to the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of the Labor Radio here on KBOO, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. Again, my name is Tina Turner-Morf, and I'm a member of the American Federation State, County, and Municipal Employees, and I'm the current president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tonight, I am joined by
Audrey Terrell, president of the NAACP here in Portland.
And what do you do belong to, sister?
I'm a retired union executive from the United Auto Workers.
Welcome aboard. Okay. Well, tonight our segment, we're going to highlight the Affordable Care Act and its impact here in Oregon. And tonight we have a guest. And she is an excellent guest, and she will help you have a better understanding of what all the hoopla about the Affordable Care Act is, and she will answer your those questions that we know that you have about this very complicated process. But before we get started into that segment, I'd like to remind you a couple of things about the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Number one, we are an international organization. We have about 51 chapters throughout the United States and Canada. We are divided into 10 regions. Oregon is located in Region 10. That includes Washington State, Nevada, Northern and Southern California. We are affiliated with the Oregon chapter of the AFL-CIO and also the national chapter. Our mission is that we are a conduit representing our respective international unions to bridge a gap between the Black community and organized labor. As I stated earlier, our segment tonight is about the Affordable Care Act, and our guest tonight is Mish Amoromatz. Sister Audrey, can you introduce our guest speaker tonight?
I would love to. This evening, we have Mish Matz with us. She's a grant and research coordinator. She graduated from Cal State University Hayward with a BA in anthropology and